Well, good to see each and every one of you. I know that some of you are unwell, but still you are able to come and join us this morning. And some faces are new to me. Well, glad that you are here, and thank you for visiting with us this morning. This morning I'm planning to deliver a message from the book of Ecclesiastes. If you know the challenge ahead of me, you may have great pity on me, because this is such a difficult book to understand. And the work is really profound. Verse 1 says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." And so it talks about the author, the preacher. The verse is beautifully divided by the son of David. The author is the preacher, which is Koheleth in Hebrew. So sometimes you may find the first word, Q, or sometimes K in Hebrew pronunciation. Q is in generally right, but some people use K. The structure of Hebrew language in this verse shows that king in Jerusalem does not refer to David, but the preacher, the son of David. So it is more than possible that it was written by King Solomon. After a brief introduction in chapter 1, verse 1, the preacher provides a sweeping generalization in chapter 1, verse 2. "Vanity of vanities," said the preacher. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." In other words, life is vain. The preacher's placement of this motive at the inception, at the beginning of the book, is where we might expect an author to place his subject. The preacher's catchword, vanity, hebel in Hebrew, is used 5 times in this verse. That this is the subject is further confirmed by the fact that the preacher concludes his work with 3 uses of vanity in chapter 12, verse 8. And chapter 12 is the last chapter of the book. So in the beginning, vanity is used, and at the end of the book, vanity reoccurs. The preacher's message begins and ends with the same message as we could see, which form literally in a literature is known as inclusio. So same thoughts are right there in between. Maybe it covers the main theme, which is found in the beginning and at the end. Within this framework, vanity is used 30 other times. Since this is undoubtedly a key term in this work, an understanding of its semantics is necessary for interpreting Ecclesiastes. So I have to go through some technical things for your understanding before I can draw out some conclusions from this study. Determining its semantics in Ecclesiastes has been a problem of no small import. And this is not the only challenge to understand the book. In the history of its interpretation, the book of Ecclesiastes has presented a plethora of difficulties. One of the major frustrations has been determining what is the basic message of this book. Life is vanity. Is there any meaning? And is there any reason for us to live continually? It sounds like very pessimistic. How do some of the negative elements, such as the preacher's hating life in chapter 2, 17, tie in with the more positive element of his commending the enjoyment of life in chapter 2, verse 24? So in the same chapter, within the same context, on the one hand, he says that he hates his life, but on the other hand, he commands us to enjoy life. Is the message of Ecclesiastes one of skepticism or hedonism because it talks about enjoying life? Many critical scholars have maintained that the preacher was a skeptic. I said critical scholars, which means normally they are liberals and they do not believe in the inerrancy and infallibility of the scriptures. James L. Crenshaw has stated that Kohelet, in quote, "Kohelet examines experience and discovers nothing that will survive death's arbitrary blow. He then proceeds to report this discovery of life's absurdity and to advise young men on the best option in the light of stark reality," end of quote. So in other words, really there is no particular spirituality. But with a pessimistic view, he makes some suggestions to the young people about how they should live. However, this type of thinking is not confined to the critical scholars, very unfortunately. A number of conservative scholars have interpreted the message of Ecclesiastes in a very similar manner. Douglas Stewart has stated that the perspective of Ecclesiastes, in quote, is the secular fatalistic wisdom that a practical atheism produces when one relegates God to a position way out there, away from us, irrelevant to our daily lives, then Ecclesiastes is the result, end of quote. In other words, it does not present any positive and any edifying lessons or truths concerning our life, and it seems that it does not really portray God enough. C.I. Scofield, who is the champion of dispensationalism in the early part of 1900s, in his correspondence, the school course, Scofield reflects the same type of thought by saying, in quote, "It is not at all the will of God which is developed, but that of man under the sun forming his own code. It is therefore as idle to quote such passages as 2:24, 3:22, etc., as expressions of the divine will as it would be to apply Job 2:4-5 or Genesis 3:4. The constant repetition of such expressions as I perceived, I said in my heart, then I saw, etc., sufficiently indicate that here the Holy Spirit is showing us the workings of man's own wisdom and his reaction in weariness and disgust," end of quote. So in other words, this book is portraying or presenting the results of man's reasoning rather than God's wisdom. That much this book is hard to understand. It also tells us, I think, in a very meaningful way, that you do not want to depend on any one particular commentary book for your Bible studies. After all, commentaries are man's work. So you need to look into the varieties of thoughts and opinions if you want to consult with commentaries. And so do not rely on any one particular person. They may have good ideas, and they may have bad ideas too. There are more positive interpretations too. While recognizing that Kohelet is a realist, R.N. Wybrey maintains that man should, in quote, enjoy to the full what good things God has given, and indeed this is what God requires of them, end of quote, when he's talking about Ecclesiastes. So, in fact, in an earlier article, Wybrey, in fact, refers to Kohelet, the preacher, as a preacher of joy. Probably some of you may disagree with that. How could we say that the contents of the book of Ecclesiastes actually bring forth any sense of or any degree of joy? How do we harmonize the preacher's apparently skeptical observations with his hedonistic advice? How do these tie in with the message of Ecclesiastes? And we shall know it by studying the meaning of vanity of life in the book of Ecclesiastes this morning. So in fact, you know, I'm not planning to go into the passage which was read a few moments ago, passage by passage or verse by verse, but overall, I'm going to talk about overall theme of the book. And so I'm going to quote from different parts of the book so that I'll bring forth the theme of this book later in the latter part of this message. If you look at chapter 1, verse 8, it says, "All things are full of labor, man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is what which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun." And if you just read it very carefully, at the end of your reading, you may say, wow, then what is the meaning of life? Why am I living today? You may become very much pessimistic. And a lot of the students of the book of Ecclesiastes were led to have that conclusion. And what I'm going to say is whether that is really true and what is the real lesson we must learn from this book. First of all, let me begin with the ground tone of the whole book. The ground tone of the whole book. It is none other than verse 2. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. First of all, the Hebrew word for vanity signifies a breath or a vapor, which is as the contrast of that which is form and enduring. In other words, a transitory thing is described by this word, vanity. It is also the figure of that which has no support or no continuance. The phrase vanity of vanity is really interesting as well. What is the difference between vanity and vanities? Vanity itself is very abstract. So you cannot count how many vanities you may have. But here is a plural form of that abstract idea. Vanity and vanities. It is a superlative expression referring to vanity in the highest degree. The double exclamation is followed by a statement which shows it to be the result of experience. It simply means that really, really, all is vain. The whole thing, whatever it may be, or whatever we are going to discuss in the following chapters in the book, is only vanity. That's what he says. It is not surprising that many, even Christians, receive the preacher's plainly stated portrayal of all that occurs under the sun as vapor, as a skepticism or unorthodoxy that requires caution, needs chastening, or is unworthy of being in the Bible. For religious individuals, a defense of God's goodness and justice in the face of the existence of evil is an understandable human reaction. So they want to defend God somehow while they are reading the book of Ecclesiastes. How come the evil one's death and the righteous one's death considered equally? And how come there is evil in existence in this world while there is good God? It doesn't make any sense. So they are trying to make a justification for the presence of evil in the presence of God. Such a question has been really recurred in many hearts. The existence of evil has been a main obstacle that has kept many people from believing in God. Such a reaction seems reasonable when confronted with the stark enigmas of life under the sun, whether confrontation comes by way of evils of this world befalling our personal realms of experience, or by candid rehearsal of this world's evils by others, such as the preacher, the writer of Ecclesiastes. The noun form of the Hebrew word, vanity, is used 73 times in the Hebrew Bible. The literal meaning of vanity is vapor and breath, as we already said. Isaiah 57, verse 13. Isaiah 57, maybe while I'm going to read it, you may want to just look up the verse as well. Isaiah 57, verse 13 says, "When thou criest, let thy companies deliver thee, but the wind shall carry them all away. Vanity shall take them. But he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain." And you do not have to know the context, but in this context, vanity is parallel with wind. So that's an idea of the word vanity. What he says is that a vanity will carry away idols. Hence the word denotes that which is evanescent, unsubstantial, worthless, or vanity. Deuteronomy chapter 32, 21 uses this word as well. Deuteronomy 32, 21 says, "They have moved me to jealousy with that which is not a god. They have provoked me to anger with their vanities. And I will move them to jealousy with those which are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation." Here, vanity is referring to idols. In other words, idols are just nothing, and vanity is something like that. This metaphor is used of vain words in Job chapter 35, verse 16, which says, "Therefore does Job open his mouth in vain. He multiplieth words without knowledge." It refers to something that is pointless in Proverbs 21:6, or fruitless in Psalm 78:33. Outside of Ecclesiastes, the metaphorical use of this word, hebel, vanity, consistently denotes something that is vain or has no value whatsoever. And so that's vanity. We can trace this metaphorical rendering back to the Septuagint translation of Ecclesiastes, which rendered this word as mataiotes, which means emptiness, futility, purposelessness, and transitoriness. Jerome translated the word with vanitas in Latin, which means unsubstantial or illusory quality, emptiness, falsity, and untruthfulness. Since that time, most versions have rendered the word hebel as vanity, and this is the rendering found in the King James, New King James, RSV, and NRSV. And the TEV deviates from this pattern by translating it as useless. The NIV does likewise, with its rendering as meaningless. The NASB translates the word as vanity 22 times, futility 12 times, fleeting twice, and emptiness once. It is important for us to recognize that the preacher describes a fallen state of mankind after the fall in the book. This is, I think, a critical point you and I need to understand. The description of his life observations is coming from the fallen condition of this world. In other words, his observations were not made in perfect God's creation, but rather fallen state of it. So that's why there are a lot of things that clashes with our biblical ideas. And it is well reflected in all perceivable difficulties and vicissitudes experienced in life. Finite man cannot figure out these results of the fall, and it frustrates the preacher in his search for meaning and purpose. So what he observes is the things that are already fallen in corruption and depravity. In his attempt to master life, the preacher eventually realizes with defeated expectations that he cannot understand God's scheme of things. So in a word, life is like a frustrating enigma. God is this, so God he has learned from his theology or the Bible seems to be different from the God who he is experiencing. Because God is good, but he could see that the good and godly men suffer while the evil ones prosper. It doesn't make any sense. So theology of God in the Bible seems to be in clash course with the God of experiences in the life. And how could he harmonize such a discrepancy and difference? Ecclesiastes 1:14. I want you to look at the verse. Ecclesiastes 1:14. It says, "I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit." If you just read verse 14, you may think that really life is vain and there is no meaning whatsoever in the life and there is no really value in the life because everything is vanity. And interesting thing is that these words are conclusions of verse 13. Verse 13 says, "And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith." In other words, all those experiences experiences he himself experienced and all those vain things he was able to observe. What he says is that even those things are the works of sovereign God. Can you see that? He talks about the vanity in the life, but he does not make it truly in vain. But rather, he says in the last part of verse 13, this sore travail hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. It appears that the preacher relates all vanities in life to the very work of sovereign God. So suddenly, those vain things become extremely meaningful to God. Certain things which seem to be so vain to our eyes seem to be extremely important and significant to God. It has really a lot of implications, and hopefully we'll be able to take some of the lessons out of it eventually. Humanly speaking, as Delitzsch says, the results of his seeing was a discovery of the fleeting, unsubstantial, fruitless nature of all human actions and endeavors. They had, as vanity expresses, no reality in them. Vexation of spirit, that this is a recurring phrase, vexation of spirit, in King James is translated as striving after wind, in ESV and NASV, and chasing after the wind in NIV. It complements vanity. This is also used in chapter 2, 11, 17, and so on. A few more passages. You can find this phrase, vexation of spirit. Whether this be a vexation of spirit, as in King James, or striving after the wind in other translations, the difference is of no consequence for our contention. If the vexation of spirit is the case, this may reflect something that troubles one's thoughts. The latter, the striving after the wind, is the case. This latter rendering reflects something that is beyond man's control. You go after wind, what can you catch? Nothing. As H. Carl Schenck has said, in quote, a man may determine or make up his mind to accomplish something eternally significant in a creation subjected to vanity, yet no matter how hard he tries, Koheleth tells him it will be a fruitless endeavor. A man in his toil under the sun grasps after the wind and attains precious little for all his labor. End of quote. Men simply cannot find the meaning of every incident in life because we are not living in paradise, but we are living in a fallen and cursed universe. There are many unreasonable and incomprehensible things to happen in life, and this is not unusual. And that's what it is. The preacher does not exclude the positive values of life by his view of life's vanity. A climactic point in this work, the preacher gives us advice to enjoy God's gifts. These gifts include food, drink, work, wealth, possessions, marital relationships, and youth. We must not forget that Ecclesiastes is a part of the wisdom books in the Bible. Though wisdom is not panacea for all of life's adversities, even the wise may suffer the hardships and frustrations in life, the preacher commended it as a solution to many of life's problems. We need wisdom to live. However, we know that wisdom itself is not going to be the solution for all the issues we may face in this life. There is a difference between creator and creatures who are living under the curse of sin. The preacher recounts his request for meaning and purpose in life. The very nature of this quest was to gain understanding into what gives life a meaning. It was not a haphazard search, but had been a thorough quest in that it took into account the range of activities occurring under the sun. He really observed every part of human activities. In passages such as 1:13, the preacher sets his mind to seek and explore by his divine given gift of wisdom all that had been done upon the earth, but his conclusion is that he couldn't comprehend everything. This is further emphasized by the preacher's observations. He saw all of man's works in 1:14, wisdom and understanding in 1:16, madness and folly in 2:12, injustice in the holds of justice in 3:16, labor produced by rivalry in 4:4, riches hurting the one who possesses them in 5:13, one whom God has not enabled to enjoy his wealth in 6:1-2. Retribution, violating a strict cause and effect relationship in 7:15. Unexpected victors in 9:11. Inappropriate leadership in 10:7. And people dying in 12:3. He thoroughly observed life events and he could find that a lot of things did not make any sense to him. He couldn't understand them. The cognitive sense of Hebel, vanity, is also stressed in chapter 6, verse 1 to 11:6. I'm borrowing a thought from Edison G. Wright's understanding of the structural unity of the Book of Ecclesiastes. He says that Ecclesiastes 6:1 to 11:6 revolves around the finite man's inability to understand God's work. In 7:1, to 8:17, the preacher punctuates this unit with not find or discover, and who can find or who can discover in 7:14, 24, 28, and so on. And in 9:1 to 11:6, the preacher emphasizes do not know and no knowledge in 9:1, 5, and so on. So he says, I do not have knowledge, any knowledge.